to the Todos Mathematics for All podcast. Each episode, we bring you discussions about equity and social justice in mathematics education. Our mission at Todos is to advocate for equity and high-quality mathematics education for all students, in particular, Latina and Latino students. I'm your host for this episode, Maria Zavala. On today's episode, we focus on social justice in mathematics education. From the work of pioneers like Marilyn Frankenstein, Arthur Powell, and other critical mathematics educators, to the mission of Todos and grassroots organizations like the Napantla Teachers Community, social justice has a history in mathematics. It can mean different things to different people. Whose vision of social justice are you committed to, and where did it come from? To advance acting on commitments to social justice in mathematics education, directors of Todos and the National Council of Supervisors of Mathematics, or NCSM, released an official position statement in 2016. At our website, www.todos-math.org, you can find this short, free document through our summer reading quick link on the right-hand side of the webpage. This position statement articulates the need to acknowledge, take action on, and hold each other accountable to social justice in mathematics education. I sat down with Dr. Julia Aguirre.
My name is Julia Aguirre. I am an associate professor in education at the University of Washington, Tacoma.
And former Todos board member and one of the authors of the position statement. In our discussion, we talked about where the idea for the position statement came from and touched on the process of organizations compromising about articulating a vision for social justice, with implications for how organizations work together around what may seem to be hard-to-broach subjects. We also talked about why social justice is hard to talk about in some spaces in math education. Our interview starts out with a discussion about the leadership involved. Diane Kinch was Todos president at the time, and John Staley was president of NCSM. Linda Fulmore was both a member of the Todos board and position papers editor for NCSM. In her interview, Julia begins by describing the liaison work Linda did between the two organizations.
Also sort of the liaison, I believe, with NCSM, so she was very active in that organization. So John extended an invitation to Todos to create a social justice, a joint social justice position paper. And as the board, we had to go through a series of conversations about, you know, whether or not we wanted to do this, whether or not we wanted to do this with NCSM, and then what our sort of terms of our collaboration would be. And so I think everyone was on board for doing something like this. What we also knew was that the joint position paper was going to have to be vetted through both boards, board of directors for both organizations, right? So, and then we had to sort of talk about, you know, if NCSM doesn't like what we do, would we still move forward in presenting our own position paper? Mm-hmm. So those are the things that we had to discuss and come to an understanding of what we as Todos wanted to do, and then talk again with John and NCSM about, you know, are those things agreeable to them? And so once we had those conversations, the major writing fell to Todos to put together this position paper. And I took the lead in drafting the position paper. And then, you know, once the draft was developed and both boards reviewed it and provided comments. And so, I mean, I remember Todos being very supportive and had some good things to include or highlight or strengthen. And I remember NCSM being reluctantly, eventually on board with the position paper. And they provided, it was really a good conversation to have with a board that's not necessarily grounded in equity, but had a president, and of course Linda was a part of the board liaison, who were active and wanted an equity, you know, stance, that organization, which is a very powerful organization, to take a stand on equity. And so there was some softening of language that happened. Some people originally felt that the draft was too militant. And you know, we had to have a conversation around how we maybe restructure some of the language to come forward. And I thought this was a good set of feedback, was to come forward with a positive affirmation of the importance of social justice, and then talk about the current inequities that we're facing right now. I think in the original draft, we led with what the current state of math education was. And so I appreciated being able to have that conversation with people and get a better understanding of why this appeared to be quote unquote militant at first, why including such things as slavery was too strong, and but segregation was left in. So there was some, I think, learnings on both sides about how we present a strong and accurate position statement that in some ways I feel, you know, took the lead in helping other organizations push for a social justice lens in math education.
Awesome. I want to come back to the idea of what has happened since the position statement. Mm-hmm. But for listeners who maybe are not as familiar with why there might be a need to compromise or what could possibly stir up a conflict about talking for social justice, could you describe a little bit of your perspective of, you know, both the need for coming out and being upfront about it in our current times, and also why there might be pushback?
So, I mean, I think what people are, when you lead with what has been historically wrong, for some that can already put up a wall of defensiveness that, that's at least in my experience when I've talked about social justice and math education, as soon as I let out the word social justice, I can in the audience usually read many people just already putting up a wall before I can even say the other things that sort of helps define what that is and examples of what that is. So I think it's important to understand that some people are uncomfortable with acknowledging and sort of seeing the inequities that we have in our current math education system that is directly connected to sort of directly connected to oppressive systems based on race and class and gender. And so when you sort of you lead with that, I think people initially were uncomfortable. But if you don't include it, then the position paper has no teeth. Mm-hmm. So what I appreciated about the discussions were helping me understand as a writer how to frame the arguments and still feel like I'm not compromising the spirit and the aim of the position paper. And so for me, that meant, you know, really highlighting things that we know for sure is an issue in math education. So we know that mathematics is a gatekeeper. That's really not debatable. But understanding the role of how math education research has created this sort of situation in which we have these strong deficit views about who can learn math and who can't. I think that that is still, people still have strong feelings about whether or not you call out the deficit discourse that is used in math education research. And that has supported language like achievement gap or other ways in which mathematics is centered on whiteness. And we really needed to, as a part of this position paper, sort of unearth or call out that this labeling of children's readiness is a problem, because you're already starting with deficit views of children as they come into school and experience school mathematics. And so those were things that I think people acknowledge, that there's tracking and that there's ranking and sorting of children. I think what was a little harder for folks is to recognize how math education research contributed to that. And I feel like we did a good job of making the case in plain language that a lot of people can at least on their own, if they want to learn more, we have citations, and if be able to have those conversations, those professional conversations with colleagues about what this actually means.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about deficit language in mathematics, that's including things like describing children as high and low,
mm-hmm.
As well as like attributing kids needing certain things because of their race, class, or language that might be framing them as missing something. English learners need English instruction before they can learn math. Those kinds of statements, right? I'm trying to think of the everyday comments that like infiltrate how we talk about children too.
Or suggestion, some of this research suggests that children are already coming in with quote unquote maladaptive strategies or immature strategies compared to their white and middle-class counterparts. And I feel like that is a label that is, the research behind that is questionable.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, sort of creates this deficit view of not only the child, but the family, right? So they're coming in from who's, in a sense, responsible for the education of children before they go into school. And it's usually people say, oh, well, the family is, and certain parents, usually mothers, are the first teachers of children. So if you sort of run that argument, then it's very easy to see how this deficit language grounded in research perpetuates these very negative stereotypes about certain communities, certain families, and the mothers of those families.
And what children need as opposed to what schools should think about. Is that another way to say it, perhaps?
I think we all want to help, you know, want to in schools that, you know, schools are designed to, are a place of learning, right? And so children have needs. It's just about whether or not you go in with the fact that certain groups of children have, greater needs based on, I think, faulty presumptions or racial stereotypes than other children.
Mm.
Like white children have needs too, right? It's mm-hmm. just that they're not presumed to be at a loss of something.
Yeah.
That they have to, that has to be filled just to get up to a very made up grade level.
Nice. So in the article, we have those three principles of acknowledgement, action, and accountability. Did you want to comment at all about how that became the framing for this position paper?
Sure. I mean, we have sort of, I think the two biggest pieces were the acknowledgement and the accountability piece. So just to acknowledge that the current math education system is unjust and grounded in a legacy of institutional discrimination, oftentimes that just goes unsaid. And so it's really important that we acknowledge what the history is and how we got here and that we're living in a legacy that we're going to have to change in order to transform math education to be what we want it to be, not a place of inequity and gatekeeping, but one of which in of liberatory, or you know, a gateway to things that people want to do in their life. And so it was really important to have this component of acknowledgement. I think a lot of people talk about actions. So we, that often is sort of a call to action or actions that we need. So I think that that was an important component as well. And we identified sort of three areas that you can take action in. So belief systems and structures to highlight the fact that this is not just an individual situation, but there are systems and structures in place that are contributing to what we're experiencing in math education. Curriculum instruction, which I think is super important for people in classrooms and who are developing for district leadership around curriculum instruction. So we always need something that sort of focuses on that component of math education. And then oftentimes the thing that usually is left out of the conversations completely are the partnering with families and communities as resources for mathematics learning. And it was really important for us to include that work and to remind people that it's not just teaching and teachers and educators involved in this. We have to have authentic partnerships with the families and communities. And, you know, that is directly connected to Martha Seville's work and others who have really helped us understand and has shown how when families and communities are engaged in mathematics learning in a respectful way that is authentic, then learning happens, math learning happens. And so that was really important and continues to be left out in other policy documents. Mm-hmm. And then accountability, you know, I guess in my experience, I really feel like there's a lot of rhetoric and good intentions for action, and yet we still haven't had any kind of show of accountability. So if people don't do it, what happens, right? So is there any, you know, follow-up critical friends in which you can see how you're doing and sort of hold yourself accountable to these actions and making change? And so it feels, and I feel like as a scholar, as an educator, as a parent myself, actions don't mean anything unless you hold yourself accountable for them. So how do, you know, NCSM and TODOS hold themselves accountable for helping our public schools, teachers, districts to take these actions and then help make changes? And that goes for other organizations like AMTE, the Association of Math Teacher Educators, and NCTM. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting also for me to notice that the accountability section is the shortest section of the paper, but in many ways it's because we don't have good accountability systems yet. But as described in the paper, these are the things that we need to do to create systems for auditing and implementation reviews and advocacy and outreach. So maybe that's a good segue to ask about what have you observed already happening in kind of the accountability realm or the impact of the position statement so far?
Well, I think from TODOS perspective, one of the things that has been really, I think, helpful was the series of pre-conference workshops that we have conducted at NCTM annual conference the last 2 years, and then at the TODOS conference in 2018. I think TODOS, again, is taking the lead in showing how this can be done, and other organizations are providing forums for folks who are interested in learning more. And so this all started with a Met grant that supported two pilot professional developments, like 3-day professional developments in Los Angeles area and New Mexico. And Rocio Benedicto and Kendall Brown and myself were part of the people who implemented those pilot professional development for teachers and teacher leaders in both of those regions. And so Rocio did it with Anita Bright the first year in New Mexico. And then Kendall and I did it in Los Angeles. And those were very well received, and it really helped us come up with some activities and tools, sort of conceptual and practical tools for teachers and teacher leaders to learn through the position statement, and also look at their own and their own instructional practices, both in the classroom and outside the classroom, that could help, that could be revised or refined or enhanced based on the components of the position paper. And that led to these 1-day pre-conference sessions at NCTM. And to our surprise, the first year it was sold out. I was surprised by that. I expected maybe 25 people, but we had over 100. And then this last year we had close to 100 people attend. And again, this is sort of an all day session workshop to introduce the position statement and activities that one can do both in the classroom and outside the classroom to support the tenets of the components of the position statement. So
and anecdotally or anything, have you heard from any participants about how things are going at their particular school systems or contexts?
I haven't. I mean, immediately after, people are following up with us, but I haven't heard since then. So, and I think that that's something that we probably could get better at, right? So one idea would be to reach out to the folks who had attended those pre-conferences and follow up with them.
Ready to read the position statement? Go to our website, and on the right-hand side under Atención Todos, you will find a link to the free download. Did you attend a session with Julia and Kindle at an NCTM meeting in the past? And can you tweet at us with the impact it had on you? Or even if you just want to share your thoughts after reading the position statement, use the hashtag TODOSPodcast. That's hashtag T-O-D-O-S podcast. The TODOS Math Podcast is a production of TODOS Math for All and is written and produced by volunteer staff. Bob McDonald and Maria Zavala produced this episode with the voices of Julia Aguirre and Maria Zavala. Music by San Francisco Bay Area artist Vectorhold. Until next time, seguimos luchando. Adios.